I'm Susan Lube with Women's Focus, and today I'm talking to Rebecca Haynes, who's a professor of media studies at Salem State University. She researches girls' media culture. I was reading your book, and I was just getting so upset at what we have to worry about with the princess culture, I guess. And the name of your book is The Princess Problem, Guiding Our Girls Through the Princess-Obsessed Years. And I had no idea that we had such a problem and that it had become a problem. I think maybe the listeners won't know that either, because it's something that really wasn't a problem a generation ago when mothers were growing up.
That's right. Yeah, this is something that's really just come about in the past 10 to 15 years, and it's really remarkable how much it's taken off and sort of taken over little girls' lives.
Tell me the difference between now and a generation ago. What is the difference?
Sure. So when I was a child growing up in the late 70s and the 80s, princesses were just part of a whole panoply of fairy tale characters and Disney characters that I think were meant for the whole family, right? So I remember Cinderella and Snow White having the exact same role in my childhood as Mickey Mouse and Pinocchio and other beloved tales. What's happened, though, in the past 10 to 15 years is Disney realized that they could capitalize on having had so many princesses over the years by grouping them into one single brand. So putting all the princesses together in their own line called Disney Princess. This was so successful that princesses actually dominated young girls' media and pop culture so completely that it is literally the number one licensed brand in the world nowadays. It's unbelievable.
And you also talked in the book about the amount of money that they make from merchandising, which is much more than they make from the films or from anything else.
That's right. And so what happens is the films might vary a lot in content. You know, the princesses from 2013 from Frozen are nothing like the princesses from, say, Cinderella. They are more active and they seem more empowered and more modern in the way that they behave. But the toys and the products like the t-shirts and the sweatshirts and the backpacks are such a money-making bonanza that they really end up regressing to the mean. All of the items regress to what all of the princesses through Disney's history have had in common, and that is they look pretty. They look nice.
So when little girls are playing with the toys, do they go back to playing the way we used to?
Well, I guess it depends on what you are thinking of when you say how we used to play. I mean, I think a lot of girls used to play princess in very open-ended ways. I think of the iconic storybook princess with like a long pointy hat and the veil coming off of it, which is nothing like the sort of sparkly tiara-bedecked makeup-wearing princess of the modern age.
Okay.
So I think it becomes less about sort of like generic princesses than reliving the stories from the screen and also embodying a princess ideal that has so much to do with being beautiful and being valued because you're beautiful and in many cases waiting for your prince. For example, I had parents tell me as I was researching my book how horrified they were when their really active little girls started lying around on the couch and in the stairs because they were waiting for their prince. You know, that really can end up being a problem.
Well, the other thing I noticed, and of course, the reason I'm so concerned about this is because I have granddaughters now. I had a son, and only a son, and I didn't worry about it at all. And now I have granddaughters. And you say that it doesn't matter if in their own family they don't experience media and they don't really hear from princesses or see princesses because they'll get it when they go to preschool or when they interact with other kids.
That's right. You know, sometimes parents say, oh, well, I'm just going to not allow that in my home. And then they are really shocked as their kids are growing up to realize that it is ubiquitous and insidious. If you go to the grocery store, Disney Princess SpaghettiOs are at eye level. If you go to Home Depot, there will be princess paints and princess seed packets. Literally, I have seen these myself. If you go to Target. There are going to be, yes, princess toys from all manufacturers, but also princess clothing. It's inescapable in the stores. It's inescapable in the preschools. And when you go to your friends' houses, what are they going to have for toys? The number one licensed property in America, you know, and in the world. So it's everywhere.
Yeah, okay. That was the scary part. And something that's happening in my granddaughter's preschool is that the toy that everyone wants to play with is a phone, because, of course, that's where you can act like your parents and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that everyone wants is the pink phone. And I thought, well, where did that come from?
So something that has really been bothering me that has arisen simultaneous to the princess thing is the pink thing. I think they're part of the same trend of sort of embracing an incredibly stereotypical girlhood that I thought we had moved beyond as a society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's saying, oh, pink is great and princesses are great, and we're going to give these things to little girls because pink and princess are so cute and so sweet. And so we're seeing in the toy aisles all kinds of products that have for ages been unisex. Like, you know the little red wagon? They make it in pink now.
Oh, no.
Girls don't need a pink version of the red wagon, nor do they need pink building blocks, right? There are mega block sets. You know, they're like one of the Lego competitors that have the big blocks for preschoolers. In addition to the multicolored sets that have every color of the rainbow, there are sets that literally only contain pink, purple, and white. This drives me crazy because what it says is if it's pink, it's for girls, and if it's anything else, it's for boys.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually narrowing girls' creative spheres and sort of reducing them by equating them to pink and princess by boxing them in and saying, well, this is what's for girls and that's it. And they don't feel comfortable in many cases crossing into another toy aisle and going to the quote unquote boys aisle and selecting a toy from that area, because preschool children developmentally are very dedicated to their sex and to being a boy or being a girl. They don't understand what makes boys boys or girls girls. So they tend to focus on stereotypical things. And if we as a society are delivering them these incredibly restrictive stereotypes, they're going to believe them and they're going to latch onto them and not feel comfortable crossing over to the other aisle.
And you said that this is the age when they're just beginning to understand about gender and get their ideas about gender and develop them. And to get the wrong idea is really difficult. I love the story that you told about the girl who dressed like a boy and played with the boys. And so tell that story.
Sure. There was one little girl whose family I spoke with who, as a preschooler, her favorite color happened to be orange. And so she would wear orange all the time. It just so happened that the kids at her preschool thought that meant she was a boy, and she loved playing with the boys. She was very active. She didn't think she was dressing like a boy. This never seemed to occur to her. But one of the boys realized one day, wait, she's a girl? And the boy stopped playing with her. So when she went to try to play with the little girls at her preschool, they pretty roundly rejected her. It was so upsetting to her and to her parents. And she ended up going through this pink phase where the parents said that it seemed like they had lost her. They had, you know, the pink version of their daughter. And it took like a year or two for her to come out of that unscathed and realize, oh, I can be myself. I don't have to look just like the other girls and in order to have friends. And they got their quote-unquote orange version of their daughter back. But it was both a sweet story and a sort of a sad story to just see how when kids become that dedicated to gender stereotypes that are delivered to them by the world around us, it can actually serve to exclude kids. And what's really important to remember is that a study that was produced by researchers at Harvard University just a couple of years ago learned that roughly one out of every 10 children is what they called gender nonconforming, which means not that they're, you know, gay or transsexual or anything like that. It doesn't signify anything about their sexual identity. It just means that they're not attracted to the things that are stereotypically associated with their gender. So we're looking at maybe 10% of girls and boys both feeling left out in the cold by how rigid the marketing of children's products and media has become in the past few years.
Well, I think now we need to talk about the ways that people have developed to be able to get different clothes and to not have to go in with the marketing. And I'm talking to Rebecca Haynes, who's the author of The Princess Problem. You give some resources in your book that you found where you can go and get other kinds of clothes.
Right. There's a wonderful website called Be Free Zone that is a spinoff of the Princess Free Zone, and they make clothes for kids that are not gendered, and they're just really cool. So a kid of either sex can feel comfortable wearing any of those shirts. There's also a brand called Quirky Kids, where they're making all of these really, really cool t-shirts for kids that happen to be fluorescent pink, but boys love them too because they have really active images on many of them. And what I think is cool about that is we really do need to get pink to become more of a mainstream color, because I think that when pink is marked as a girl's color, it is kind of used against girls in a lot of ways by boys saying, ooh, pink, I don't want to touch that, you know?
So do you think that can really happen, that we can reclaim pink?
I think it would take a lot of intentionality, you know. But what's interesting is that if you look at older kids, like high school age kids, high school age boys will kind of wear like fluorescent pink now sometimes. It's really interesting. And kids who have a global perspective also are become really intrigued by the fact that in Japan, pink is considered a manly color. I've had students at Salem State University who are exchange students from Japan, and when I teach advertising classes, I have students bring in products from home to discuss the packaging as forms of advertising, and every now and then, one of the men from Japan will bring, I think they do it on purpose because they know the stereotype in the U.S. is pink is for girls. They'll bring, like, a pink shaving cream package, and all the students will say, what? And it's that there's no such cultural association there. So it helps to unpack the idea that it is innately somehow a feminine color. And historically, too, I think that scholars like Joe Paoletti, who wrote Pink and Blue, Telling the Boys from the Girls in America, and Elizabeth Sweet, who has had some really interesting articles lately in the New York Times and the Atlantic, they have really been unpacking the way that, like, even in the 1940s and 50s, this pink and blue association didn't exist in the way that it does now. And historically, blue was actually associated with girls because blue is the color of the Virgin Mary, and pink was associated with boys because it's the diminutive form of red, which is considered a strong, masculine, king-like color. So this is all culturally, socially constructed.
Well, the other thing that people say as I've been talking to them about this is they'll grow out of it. You know, you go through a princess phase and it's like 4 years or something like that, mm-hmm. and then they grow up and they grow out of it. So is it something that we don't really need to worry about?
My concern, and the concern of many people who have worked with families in this area, is this. Yes, they grow out of princesses, but they don't grow out of some of the patterns that princess culture sort of instills upon them. So, for example, if a little girl dresses up as a princess and goes out in public, which kids do, like if you go to the grocery store or to a department store, you'll sometimes see little girls walking around in princess gowns or mm-hmm. wearing a tiara.
Yeah.
They get huge amounts of feedback and praise from everyone they encounter saying, oh, aren't you a pretty little girl? Aren't you a pretty little princess? Oh, you're so pretty. Girls get hooked on this external validation and the idea that how they look is important and valuable, and that sets them on a pathway for when they've grown out of princesses to still be very concerned with their appearance.
Okay.
So although the princess phase goes away, some of the baggage that comes with princesses is there to stay.
Okay. Okay, that's the answer. Okay, so I want to get to the racism of it, because that's really important for New Mexico. But before we do that, I think we need to offer listeners some encouraging news or some encouraging things that they can do. And you have a lot of tips of how to deal with this as parents. And the one I really liked is watching media with your children. So let's go into coaching principles, that you call them.
Sure, yeah. You know, there's a lot of strong evidence that when parents watch media with their children and talk about what's on screen. Talk back to the screen. Talk to the kids during the screening. Talk to the kids about what they saw later during dinner or while they're driving around in the car. That parents can really effectively counteract some of the negative stereotypes and messages that are contained in the media text. So, for example, if you are watching Beauty and the Beast, and the Beast starts yelling at Belle or yelling at her father, you can say to the screen, I really don't like it when he talks that way to her. No one should talk that way to a woman, or no one should talk that way to anybody. That's really not right. Your child will hear you expressing your values, right? And they will absorb that. And the reason that this is important is that studies have found that when parents just sit and watch but don't talk back to the screen, children perceive their parents as being acquiescent, as agreeing with what's shown on the screen. Mm-hmm. So making it clear how you feel and just keeping avenues of communication open with your child is really healthy for countering those messages while still letting them enjoy, you know, the fun, entertaining part of these programs and movies.
Okay. And the other thing that was interesting to me about that was, for instance, my grandchildren don't watch television and they aren't allowed to watch television and they very little watching of things on cell phones and computers and stuff like that. They're quite young still. But you're saying that you really need to have some kind of media exposure with your children so that you can kind of counteract what happens to them in the outside world.
Right. I mean, I think every family needs to make choices that are right for their family. So I wouldn't say that a family that's really committed to being screen-free should start watching television.
Okay.
But I really respect families' individual choices. But I would say that if your child is going to be at other people's homes watching television without you, and you are not watching with them at home and talking back to the screen, they're not going to have your voice in their head saying, oh, he's not treating her right, or, oh, I don't like how they're all focused on the way she looks. So it is helpful to have these conversations about, you know, what's happening on screen with the child. But I suppose you could do the same thing with books, right? You could similarly, while reading books, point out, I'm not sure how I feel about the way they're behaving there, or, gee, I wish that they weren't focusing on that. Mm-hmm. And I think you could impart the values that way as well if you're really, you know, making an intentional choice of saying, no, we are screen-free.
Okay, the other thing that I liked that you brought out about media was that someone behind the film or behind the book, I guess, is making a decision about what this character is going to say and how the character is going to act. Because it's so easy to get wrapped up in the story and forget that, you know, there's somebody who's deciding all this.
Yeah, little kids really do see media as a window into some other part of the world. I mean, in many cases, they do come to understand pretty early on that it's fictitious, but it just, especially when it's on screen, it seems so real. So letting kids know that whether it's television or movies or books, it's somebody's job to make these stories and to put these words in these characters' mouths, right? These characters aren't really making these choices. Knowing that some other grown-up thought it would be a good idea for the character to do that really helps the kids start thinking critically about, oh, this doesn't have to be that way. Somebody chose for this to be that way. And I even suggest that making simple things with the child to give them a sense of being a media creator, whether you're writing little books together or getting, you know, simple videos created through, like, the camera on your smartphone, that really helps give them that perspective as well.
Okay, that's great. I love that. Well, let's talk about racism, because that's really important.
Sure.
And you go into that a lot. I guess you start with the racism that's still there in characters.
Right. You know, what's tricky about princess media and race is that princesses have long had the concept of fairness, of the fairest of them all, and this fairness referring to, you know, the sort of creamy white complexion you would associate with Snow White, or, you know, a princess with golden tresses, right? So there's this very racialized white ideal surrounding princesses. And when you look at Disney's princesses. They've really made an effort to be multicultural and inclusive. So when they launched the Disney Princess line, they included Mulan as one of the Disney princess characters, even though she's not a princess, because I think they wanted to be racially diverse. And they also included Jasmine, who is a Middle Eastern princess from the movie Aladdin. But these stories that they tell often do have sort of, you know, racist undertones and racial issues. Like in Mulan, they actually include elements in the story that make it seem like that culture, that the Chinese culture in which Mulan was set, was more oppressive towards women than it was. They invent from whole cloth the idea of matchmaking, which did not exist in that society. So when you combine that with the fact that then it took years for them to come up with an African-American princess, when, by the way, Disney has a horrible track record in its films of not representing Black characters on the big screen, and instead, anytime there's some place that there would be people of color, they have animals representing them, like the Lion King set in Africa with no people at all. It's kind of a big problem. And then characters like Tiana from The Princess and the Frog have this burden of representation, whereas the only Black princess, you know, she's meant to satisfy all the dreams and wishes of the families who are African-American who would be watching that film. And unfortunately, she can't satisfy everyone. And why should she? I mean, there are, I don't know, 9 or 10 white princesses who all have very different characters. And so then to really just have this one princess who is the African-American one, and by the way, to not have a Latino princess at all, I don't know, it's too limiting. It reduces an entire population down to just this one image that then spends most of her time on screen hopping around as a frog.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a shame, you know, especially when they have that bad track record of representing characters that would be people of color as animals, like in The Lion King and The Jungle Book. It's just a shame.
Well, I'm talking to Rebecca Haynes, and we're talking about her book, The Princess Problem. You make a lot of good suggestions about how parents can work with their kids, even at a young age, not to be a racist or to impart the fact that the parents aren't racist. So let's give some of those tips.
Right. So I have some tips that are for white readers and some tips that are for readers of color. And I own that as a white woman, I may not be the best person to give advice to people of color, but I certainly tried my best to dig up the best sources possible from the scholarly literature.
Mm-hmm.
But for white parents, it's really important to articulate clearly to your children that you like diversity and that you think it's a good thing, that there's so many different skin tones and cultures in the world, and that that makes the world a more interesting place. Studies have found that when white parents try to be colorblind and not talk about it and assume that if they don't say anything about race, they won't inadvertently make their kids racist, well, the opposite happens. The kids get the wrong idea. And then for families of color, I'm not going to say anything that parents of color don't already know right now, but a lot of parents of color do prepare their children to understand how they might be discriminated against in the world around them, right? And so they sort of teach them about why these inequities are there. And I think talking with them about what's on screen and how limiting it is and making sure that they know that it's not just is very important. There are alternative sources for diverse princess characters. If there are little girls out there who want to see more racial diversity, for example, I recommend the Guardian Princess Alliance, which is a book series that is completely independent and was launched through a Kickstarter campaign about a year ago.
Mm.
And there's such beautiful racial diversity. There's a princess, and they keep coming out with the new ones, but there's a princess of, I mean, it feels like every culture. They're very sensitively done. They're done by women of color who are writing these. So they're not authored by some white people trying to be white saviors in a really problematic way.
Mm-hmm.
And these princesses in this book series all have jobs as guardians of their people and guardians of the environment. So rather than being fixated on, you know, romance and fashion and fun, they're actually good role models in what they do as well.
Wow, that
so
sounds great.
Finding alternative sources is really important.
And so where can you find those?
You can get those online. And I just want to be clear, too. I actually think they're great for white families to provide their kids, because white kids need to see a diversity of representations as well to get the idea that it's, you know, this is not something that's just for white people. Because I heard so many stories from parents and kids from before Disney put out The Princess and the Frog, of little black girls being bullied and told that they couldn't be princesses because princesses weren't black.
Oh, boy. Wow.
They're really sad.
It's really, yeah, it's scary. Okay, so one of the things you said is don't assume that kids are colorblind.
Mm-hmm.
Kids in, I guess it's in preschool, where they start to realize that people are different and that you have to guide them when they're doing that.
Yeah, you know, if a kid comes home and comments on skin color, you kind of have to be prepared, you know, to realize that, oh, yeah, at 3 or 4, they're not colorblind and they're starting to notice these differences. And just affirm that the differences they're seeing are good. And find books. There are lovely books on multiculturalism that are not princess-related at all, you know, but are just, I list them in my book as resources. Books showing people from diverse backgrounds being friends with one another. I think that's really important no matter what your family's racial or ethnic background is.
And I found that at that age, the teachers and the care providers work with colors so much that it's really at the top of their mind.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they're learning literally what the colors of the rainbow are. So it does make sense that at that age, they would start noticing variations in skin tone.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a picture of you at a birthday party dressed as a princess. And you didn't really explain that as far as I could see.
Do you remember when Gloria Steinem did I Was a Playboy Bunny, and she went undercover as a Playboy Bunny?
Sure.
Okay, so I thought, oh, I could do that with princesses. So I was.
You were doing research.
So I was doing research. So I actually got a part-time job. I applied and was hired to work at children's birthday parties by a company that does princess parties. And we were like generic storybook princesses, right? So The Little Mermaid and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, things like that. And that was just an opportunity for me to see, like, the most celebratory part of princess culture up close. And I talked with a lot of other women who did this kind of work. And it was really interesting to learn about how some of the women who do these princess parties would kind of subvert the stereotypical media version. Not all of them would, because not everyone has a critical conscience, but some who did would say things like, oh, well, of course Prince Charming isn't here with me today. It was his turn to stay home and clean the castle.
Oh, good.
So it was really fun. And I love little kids. So I really enjoyed actually being their empowered party princess, but getting this firsthand look of, oh my gosh, look at how this entire room is full of pink Disney stuff. And oh, look at how much the parents are spending on the princess themed party. And just getting that up close and personal about it, with the approval from my university. I had my authorization to do that kind of field research. It was really, really cool.
And did you try to subvert it, or would that have changed the research?
Oh, no, I did a little bit, because I certainly wasn't going to go and be a stereotypical princess. I just wanted that firsthand look. But so, for example, at one party where I played Cinderella, we had to, you know, we had to do all kinds of things like face painting and making balloon animals. And this little girl who was a little older than the birthday girl was kind of watching me make balloon animals. And I was making the balloon animals into swords and giving them to the girls and saying, hey, I think you could go fight those boys, and sort of, you know, letting them feel that they were strong as well, because all the boys wanted swords. But this one little girl comes up to me and she said, I think Cinderella does more things now than she did when I was a kid. And I said, well, you know, everybody has to keep growing and changing. It's really important for us to just, you know, continue to learn new things and become better people all the time.
It's interesting that she noticed it at a party.
She really did. Yeah, she really did. And she wanted me to teach her to make balloon animals. And she was just, like, really intrigued by this more self-assured Cinderella, I guess, and which speaks to me about how much girls really do want stronger role models. I think the reason that princesses like Rapunzel from Tangled and Merida from Brave and Anna and Elsa from Frozen have been so popular with little girls is that they do break out of that passive, pretty sweet mold, and they've got a little bit of attitude and more personality.
Yeah. Well, you do have a section in your book about what's good about princess culture. So we should maybe we should bring out a little bit of that.
Sure. You know, I think that it is nice for girls to feel celebrated, right? To feel that there's something special about being a girl. And even in some ways, it is okay for them to feel like there's something that's just for them, right? Because children of that age do have sort of an in-group mentality where they want to celebrate being a girl, or the boys want to celebrate being a boy. And it's nice for them to have something of their own, as long as they're not told that's the only thing they can have, right? I also think that princess sparkles and play can just be really, really fun for a little kid to just imagine what a different life is like. And what's great is if you can take that interest and mix it up as a parent and help them sort of come up with their own twist on things, so that rather than reenacting a story from a movie, they're expanding maybe what the possibilities are for princess characters. So, for example, one dad that I interviewed who was really good at this, his daughter loved princesses and she loved fire trucks. And one year she wanted as her gifts both a princess castle and a fire truck, and the parents got her both. And then she had the Disney princesses in the fire truck putting out a fire in the castle and rescuing other characters.
Great.
So just kind of, you know, subverting the idea that the princesses are damsels in distress and making them heroes, I think was fantastic.
Yes, I think that is. That's great. Well, tell me about your own kids.
Okay, so I have two little boys. One is 2 and one is 6.
Oh, okay.
So they are actually in that,
yes,
that like preschool, early childhood spot. So they're boys, and so they're not the princess target audience. But actually, and I think this is proof that despite what some people sometimes say about, oh, you must hate princesses, I don't hate princesses because I have my boys watch princess movies. I want them to respect the things that girls like. I want them to see princesses and see that this is not something to be dismissive or condescending for, because I never want my children, who are boys, to think that things that are girlish are dumb or stupid. So, you know, we watch these princess movies together and we talk about them, just like I suggest people do in my books.
Right.
And it's been wonderful to talk. Well, the 2-year-old is a little too young for it, but with the 6-year-old especially, it's been wonderful to talk about some of these things that come up in the movies that are problematic, and to hear him say them back to me later when he's thought about them, you know. And even with things that aren't specifically about princess media, like commercials, he used to ask me what the commercials were and why they were there, and he was just very curious. And I said, well, commercials are trying to sell us things we don't need. And that was the answer, the stock answer that I would give him. And then one day I thought it was great when I was in the kitchen making dinner and he was in the living room watching TV, and he called out to me, Mommy, the commercial's trying to sell me things I don't need. I was like, this is great.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. Well, how about your students? Do they get as upset as I did when I first heard about this?
You know, it really varies. Some of them get really concerned and say, I never thought of it that way before. Yesterday, I did a guest lecture for a political science class at my university where I talked about my research. And afterwards, some of the kids looked a little shell-shocked, and the professor asked them what they were thinking. And they said, this has changed my perspective. I never thought about this that way before. Others get really defensive because they have such nostalgia for Disney. Disney is such a huge source of happy childhood memories for so many people that, frankly, I think that's part of how they get away with this, because parents look back and say, I loved Disney. I want to give my children Disney princesses too. And they don't realize what they're in for because they're so different than they were when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, that's what I want to bring out. It isn't the same.
Yeah. No, it really isn't the same. And so my students, they actually grew up with this kind of princess culture. They probably were born in the early 90s, so they were there when, like, The Little Mermaid was already really, really popular. So for some of them, it's really hard to hear this because this is very personal for them. But others, what's interesting is if their parents used to have these kinds of conversations with them, they are much more equipped to talk about this during class. I had one young woman who said to me, you know what, when I was little, I was really obsessed with Mulan because she was half Chinese, and she loved seeing a character that looked like her on screen. And then one day her father, who is the one of her parents that is of a Chinese background, said to her, "You know, I want to tell you something. You are not Mulan. Our people were the Huns." And she was just horrified to realize that the characters that are on screen that are depicted as almost inhuman, with like yellowy skin and scary, beady little eyes and just really creepy looking, were her ancestors. Oh. It just sort of changed her perspective and helped her realize, oh, this is actually kind of racist too, and just gave her a better critical apparatus moving forward. So the parenting really matters.
Wow. So it's interesting, the experience that they have, that they kind of relive their whole past and through this kind of cultural awareness.
I think so. But it's such an important skill for them to develop, even as college students. You know, all of us should be media literate. And it's really unfortunate that in the United States, we're lagging behind other countries in providing media literacy education as part of our student schooling. Mm-hmm. But getting people to understand what it means to be media literate in the first place and why thinking critically about what's on screen is as important as thinking critically about what's on the page has been a little bit of an uphill battle. But
yeah,
it's important.
Do you have other books that you want to recommend to people that of yours?
Well, there's another book that I published in 2012 it's written a little bit more as a textbook. So my other book is called Growing Up with Girl Power, Girlhood on Screen and in Everyday Life. And I think that for your listeners who are maybe young adults, it's a really interesting look back at how representations of girlhood changed with the girl power movement from the early to mid-90s onward, and how we had this period really leading up to when princess culture took off at the turn of the last millennium of these girls as superheroes with superpowers.
Yeah.
And, you know, how we got there and why. So when I assign that to my students to read, they love it. They say, "Oh, my gosh, you're explaining my whole childhood to me."
Great. Okay, so there's two things that will help our listeners deal with this new princess culture. Do you think that this is just a phase then and that we'll be out of it? Or do you think that Disney's making so much money, it'll go on?
Well, you know what's interesting to me about looking at the holding power of princess culture in comparison to something like girl power is that girl power was really targeting older girls. And older girls become savvy enough to say, "Oh, that's not cool anymore," right?
Mm-hmm.
When Disney starts targeting girls at age 2, there's none of that. They have sort of found the holy grail of marketing, where they've got this, what I call, or what other people call, cradle-to-grave marketing, in which children grow up with Disney, and especially the females with the princesses. They love them. Then later in life, they get married, they have babies, and they provide them instantly to their children with this sense of nostalgia that I think really means it's going to be around a long time. It's going to be hard to break this cycle. I think parents would have to say, "Whoa, enough of the princess stuff," because the kids don't know any better and don't really have a say. A 2-year-old doesn't really have a say in what toys she gets or what media she watches.
Yeah, you're right. Well, okay, a little bit of encouragement and some discouragement.
I'm sorry.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing this with us. And I've been talking to Rebecca Haynes about her book, The Princess Problem, Guiding Our Girls Through the Princess Obsessed Years. And I have to admit, I became a little obsessed with it as a grandmother.